Welcome to Hematologic Oncology Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Jonathan Friedberg, who commented on a number of data sets presented on lymphomas at the recent ASCO meeting, beginning with an intriguing report on the use of the immune modulatory agent lenalidomide in primary CNS lymphoma.
This is a disease, of course, that has always been a struggle to treat. And there was a very interesting abstract from Dr. Rubenstein from UCSF that looked at using lenalidomide therapy to treat CNS lymphoma. He demonstrated that lenalidomide did cross the blood-brain barrier, and he demonstrated fairly durable responses in a collection of patients who otherwise would have been felt to have very refractory disease with good tolerability.
I think there was also another data set at ASH looking at ibrutinib in these patients. Am I correct?
That's right. And they did update that, I think, in a poster, basically showing that it was safe and potentially effective. I think the lenalidomide is perhaps more promising in the sense that we've had more experience using lenalidomide with systemic large cell lymphoma, demonstrating responses. And it's a drug clearly that many oncologists are very comfortable using in that scenario.
When the ibrutinib data came out, I remember in the presentation they talked about CNS lymphoma being like, I think it was non-GBC diffuse large B cell?
That's right. When you do gene expression on patients with CNS lymphoma, the vast, vast majority of them are non-germinal center or likely activated B cell type of diffuse large B cell lymphoma, which probably explains their relative refractoriness to standard treatment.
So do you yourself manage patients with CNS lymphoma? And if so, how do you treat them?
So I manage patients with systemic lymphoma that goes to the CNS. I do not see the patients with primary CNS lymphoma. The data set that Jim presented included both groups of patients, relapse disease from systemic as well as relapse disease from primary CNS lymphoma. And both groups of patients appear to respond to the lenalidomide.
Could you see using it right now outside a trial setting in patients? And if so, in what setting?
I could, because many of these patients are elderly patients. They're the group of patients that both in the systemic lymphoma side have the highest risk of CNS progression. And the disease primary CNS lymphoma tends to be a disease of older patients. And right now, many of those patients may not even be able to tolerate standard induction type treatments that include very high doses of methotrexate. In that scenario where you have very limited options, I think lenalidomide is very appealing given favorable tolerability and efficacy in this relatively small study that was presented.
You mentioned that you treat, of course, systemic diffuse large B cell lymphoma. And one of the things that we've seen over and over the last couple of years, and we saw it just recently at ASCO when we did a symposium on lymphomas again, is that when we poll general oncologists and say, have you used lenalidomide in relapse refractory diffuse large B cell? A lot of them say no. And yet when we poll investigators, they all say they use it. I gather you do too.
I do. And I think that I've seen patients referred to me where if you have an older patient who's not a transplant candidate and they've had standard R-CHOP and the disease progresses, that's an incurable situation. And I'll often see in that scenario, oncologists using cocktails of modifications of salvage regimens, a modified ICE type of regimen, or high-dose cytarabine. I think lenalidomide has been shown to be just as active as that type of treatment with far less toxicity. And it's really become my go-to therapy for relapsed diffuse large B-cell lymphoma in a transplant-ineligible patient when there is not a clinical trial available.
Let's talk about data sets from ASCO related to indolent lymphomas, beginning with follicular lymphoma. And there was an interesting data set presented out of ECOG looking at the addition of bortezomib upfront. Can you talk about that?
Sure. This was a trial that was of interest because many years ago, John Leonard and Julie Vose, the three of us, really put together a trial combining bortezomib with bendamustine and rituximab. And not surprisingly, we saw a very high response rate, particularly in follicular and mantle cell lymphoma, and there seemed to be reasonable tolerability. So that's gone on to randomized trials, and this was an ECOG study that is really looking at two parts. One, upfront, they compared standard bendamustine and rituximab to the combination of bendamustine, bortezomib, and rituximab. And the primary endpoint there was complete response rate. Then they went on and did a second arm that looks at lenalidomide as part of maintenance therapy, and that we don't have the results. But the first part of the study that looks at the bortezomib question, the CR rate was much higher in the patients treated with bortezomib compared to those who got bendamustine and rituximab alone. The tolerability was reasonably good. They did modify the schedule of bortezomib. It wasn't given on a 1-4, 8, and 11 schedule. And with the modification and giving it subcutaneously, of course, neuropathy continued to be more in the group who got bortezomib, but it seemed to be tolerable and relatively low grade. And I think that what was compelling is that most patients were able to get all of the prescribed bortezomib so that you weren't having to dose modify that drug very often. And, you know, at this point, I'm not sure it's yet ready to say that this is a new standard in follicular lymphoma, but I think it's intriguing and it will be very important to follow these patients. Because one of the things we've learned in follicular lymphoma is that it too is a heterogeneous disease, and most patients do very, very well. But the way to identify the subset of patients who do less well includes looking at a PET scan at the end of therapy and looking for the time to progression after first therapy. And you can envision that if you have a better response up front, it's more likely your PET scan will be negative and you'll have a longer response. So it will be interesting to see if this higher CR rate does translate to maybe changing the natural history of the disease. At the presentation, Andrew Evans, who gave the presentation, also promised us in the future extensive correlative analyses that may help us to define who these patients are who benefit from this treatment.
What exactly was the impact in terms of progression-free survival and overall survival?
So at this point, they didn't show either of those significantly. It was really still a response analysis. I think it's going to be very, very difficult to show an impact on overall survival based on the number of patients that were enrolled in this trial. It was a relatively small phase two trial. But progression-free survival, as you imply, I think will be a very important endpoint once follow-up is longer. Because I think if you're able to show that this higher CRA translates to a longer progression-free survival, I think that may begin to suggest that we might be impacting the patients who are at the highest risk of having a poor outcome ultimately with this disease.
You know, also, you said the CR rates were higher, but what I see here is 74% versus 58%.
Right.
Doesn't exactly sound like a home run.
No, but I mean, I think that's an incremental benefit. And honestly, in follicular lymphoma, we don't generally see CR rates that are much higher than that. Keep in mind that in the BRIGHT study, which was R-CHOP versus BR in follicular lymphoma, which had response rate and CR rate as an endpoint, the response rate was, of course, very high, but the CR rate for both arms was in the 30 to 35% range. So these CR rates are actually higher than we've normally seen in both arms. That may speak to some degree of the population of patients that were enrolled in this trial. It may also speak to more sophisticated use of PET scans today compared to some of the earlier trials.
How much interest is there right now in the research community looking at other proteasome inhibitors? You know, myeloma, they have carfilzomib. Now they've got an oral proteasome inhibitor, exazomib. Is there any interest in looking at these in lymphomas?
I'd say the interest in lymphoma has been modest and, you know, perhaps unfairly so. We've seen some recent data in mantle cell lymphoma that also suggests that bortezomib given upfront has a meaningful impact when added to standard chemotherapy. Our group and a couple of other groups have looked at carfilzomib in some niche indications in lymphoma, and the response rates of carfilzomib in lymphoma have been disappointingly low. That's been recapitulated in two or three trials, and I think for that reason, quickly people lost interest. Some of the other newer ones, though, including the oral ones, I think would clearly make sense to study. I'm not aware of a major, larger group indication, but you know, if this data with bortezomib persists in its benefit, in other words, if we see a significant change in progression-free survival, I think that may change the equation a little bit. And you can envision including an oral proteasome inhibitor in an oral cocktail that might include some of the other novel agents in follicular lymphoma.
So I have to say, I wish I was talking to you a couple of months in the future. I don't know when we're going to see data, but there is this really intriguing press release that's out there about the anti-CD20 monoclonal antibody obinutuzumab in follicular lymphoma compared to rituximab up front that we don't know the numbers, but supposedly is going to show some advantage. You know anything about that and any thoughts about it?
I only know the press release, and it surprises me, honestly. And I think that I spoke to some of my colleagues at ASCO about what their reception is. I think our consensus was we really need to wait to see that data. Obinutuzumab, of course, is a novel CD20 antibody that's approved in the treatment of CLL, and it was shown in a randomized trial combined with chlorambucil to be better than the chlorambucil-rituximab combination. In follicular lymphoma, it was recently approved in relapse disease in an indication that was enrolling patients who were refractory to rituximab, and it demonstrated some benefit when combined with bendamustine. But that study, I think, was complicated by the fact that one arm got a prolonged maintenance phase and the other arm did not. And it really, I think, made a lot of us question how much it was really adding. Obviously, the real question is obinutuzumab better than rituximab in follicular lymphoma? There was one randomized trial that was conducted, a phase two trial, comparing the two antibodies head to head. And in that trial, there was no difference in progression-free survival, although responses were better with obinutuzumab. Despite that negative trial, the company did do a large phase three trial, as you just mentioned, combining obinutuzumab with standard chemoimmunotherapy. I think it'll mainly be bendamustine, and comparing it to BR. And all we know is that the press release suggests that the trial's been stopped due to a positive result. But I am imagining at ASH we'll see that data, and I think it's going to be very important for us to understand what the magnitude of benefit is, because it would be a significant change in practice for us to switch out rituximab for that other antibody.
Well, I know there were a lot of surprised people when the CLL data came out, and then, you know, there's some questioning, you know, chlorambucil, et cetera, and then I started to see people use it. There, I guess you had the concept of, well, rituximab doesn't seem to be as effective in CLL as it is in lymphomas, but I guess we're just going to have to wait, as you said. Just out of curiosity, incidentally, do you use it in CLL?
So I've given it to a couple of patients with CLL who are elderly. I've used that chlorambucil-obinutuzumab combination, but I think now with the ibrutinib wider approval, that's largely replaced the obinutuzumab combination for the CLL population that I was using it for.
So let's talk about mantle cell lymphoma, and I'm curious what new strategies and agents are being looked at right now in clinical trials.
So there are a few key themes in mantle cell lymphoma that are evolving. Clearly, I think we'd like to try to take the very exciting data we've seen in the relapse setting with lenalidomide and with ibrutinib and move it up front. And John Leonard's group from Cornell did publish a series in the New England Journal of Medicine a few months ago that showed in a single-arm study that a group of patients with mantle cell lymphoma who got lenalidomide and rituximab up front had very long remission durations and really looked like they were doing as well as a group of patients who would undergo transplant. So I think that there's interest in trying to figure out how to better refine that. Another theme in mantle cell lymphoma that we're interested in the cooperative groups is this issue of minimal residual disease. The assays to detect minimal residual disease in the blood or the bone marrow have become much more robust. And I think we're now able to really use that almost in place of a PET scan to figure out who's really in a deep remission and who isn't. And we're anticipating trying to ask the question in the cooperative groups, if you're MRD negative after your induction therapy, do you even need a transplant? Will a transplant benefit you? And we're planning a randomized trial with an overall survival endpoint, which I think will be very, very interesting. And I think the third theme in mantle cell lymphoma is to figure out what the best induction strategy is for the younger patients. I can tell you there is not a consensus in this direction. I think there are a group of investigators who feel similar to perhaps the myeloma situation, that we need to keep adding and we need to continue what we've seen as far as incremental improvements by taking a platform of therapy such as the Nordic regimen that includes high-dose cytarabine and high doses of R-CHOP and a transplant, and then add new drugs to that. I think another group of investigators feels that maybe that's overkill and that what we need to do is back off on some of the chemotherapy and see if we can get to a time when we're only using the novel agents. And I think those are going to sort themselves out through a series of randomized trials conducted both in Europe and in the United States.
So let's talk a little bit about CLL. And maybe to get into that, you can talk about your patient, your 68-year-old man.
Yeah, I met him kind of midway through his course. He was diagnosed in 2001 with CD38 positive, ZAP70 positive CLL that in retrospect had both deletion of 13 and deletion of 11. He was initially followed without treatment, but in 2005, he began to develop symptomatic lymphadenopathy with a minor component of lymphocytosis. Got FC chemotherapy at that time. And then in 2008, he had recurrence again and got FCR. And I met him briefly at that time. He had only had a moderate amount of FCR, so we gave him a longer course of FCR. And then since then, he's been managed with new agents, and it's really been remarkable because this was a patient who became refractory to FCR chemotherapy. Historically, these patients had a survival that maybe lasted less than a year. In fact, that was a labeled indication. If you were fludarabine refractory, there was data with alemtuzumab that you would survive only about a year. And he's been alive now for about 6 years. He got a novel BTK inhibitor with bendamustine and rituximab on a clinical trial. And then when ibrutinib was approved, he was switched to ibrutinib. He did well until he progressed after ibrutinib. He then got a PI3 kinase inhibitor on a clinical trial. He only had a brief response. And then more recently, he started venetoclax, and he's done very well on venetoclax.
So I'm going to go through a few of these things. First, you mentioned that he received an experimental BTK inhibitor. Can you talk about what we know about BTK inhibitors beyond ibrutinib? I've heard about acalabrutinib. What are the ones out there that potentially might have some advantage over ibrutinib?
Personally, I think it's maybe a challenge for many of these to demonstrate superiority over ibrutinib in the CLL space. If you treat patients even with high-risk CLL with ibrutinib, the vast, vast majority of them are going to respond. And it's hard for me to picture that these newer agents are going to be better. I think where there's a potential is certainly in patients who become refractory to ibrutinib. Can we overcome the resistance mechanism of the BTK binding site? And that's certainly one question. And the other issue with ibrutinib that continues to be an important issue is bleeding risk. And I think that many of these patients, I see them all the time in clinic, are on anticoagulation for atrial fibrillation or other indications. And we all are nervous about giving ibrutinib in that situation. There was some data that suggests that maybe it is safe or with certain strategies you can do it. It's maybe safer with heparin than with warfarin. But I think if you had a drug that clearly showed less of a propensity for a bleeding risk in that scenario, it could become a very important agent. The agent that is most developed is acalabrutinib. There was some data that was published in the New England Journal not long ago showing its efficacy. There's some smaller companies that also have BTK inhibitors, and many of these are being tested in combinations. So rather than develop these as single agents like ibrutinib was developed, they're being developed in combinations with other novel agents, so novel combinations that I think do hold some significant promise.
At this point, what's your take on the risk of atrial fibrillation with ibrutinib?
I've certainly seen it. I had one patient who came in and was asymptomatically in atrial fibrillation. He'd never had that before, and it was only about 2 or 3 weeks after starting ibrutinib. So if you look at the large series, as well as what's out there in the literature, The risk is relatively low, but present. It's probably on the order of 5 to 10%. Of course, the issue then is if you develop atrial fibrillation, there's often pressure by the cardiologist to give some sort of anticoagulation, even around a cardioversion. And I think that then complicates the ibrutinib therapy. So it's clearly an issue. It's something that people should watch for. I will say that the majority of patients that I've put on ibrutinib have stayed on it for a very durably long period of time.
What about the other BTK inhibitors, particularly acalabrutinib, in terms of bleeding, atrial fibrillation, et cetera?
So the early data suggests there may be a little bit of a lower risk of atrial fibrillation, but I think that we have to be very careful to directly compare based on a real-world experience in the ibrutinib scenario and a more narrow clinical trial experience. Many of us didn't really appreciate the atrial fibrillation until after ibrutinib got approved and it was used more widely.
I want to ask you what your current algorithm is in the first line for CLL and where ibrutinib fits in, but I have to ask you because it was actually a doc in practice brought a case up to me that I thought was pretty interesting of a patient with 17p deleted CLL who had atrial fibrillation, was on anticoagulation, and the doc was saying, well, maybe I should give this patient venetoclax. So what is venetoclax, and do you think that is a reasonable thought in this situation?
Yeah, I mean, so the venetoclax, a BCL2 inhibitor, was approved for patients with 17p deleted CLL that had already seen ibrutinib. So it's a pretty narrow approval indication. It was really designed for patients who are refractory to ibrutinib, but I mean, there's clearly a patients who are considered intolerant. Whether somebody who's on anticoagulation is really intolerant, I think is a question. It's not an unreasonable thought, though, because the efficacy of venetoclax has been, you know, at least in early days here, outstanding in these patients. And I think that it's not necessarily that you're compromising the patient by not giving them ibrutinib. In fact, some feel that venetoclax may be superior to ibrutinib in that specific histology or subset of CLL. Whether it becomes more widely used, I think, remains to be seen. Venetoclax is a little more cumbersome. There's this risk of tumor lysis. So particularly if there's active disease, sometimes it requires admission to the hospital and very careful laboratory monitoring. But my patient had very bulky disease. And, you know, he walked in to clinic with lymph nodes that you could see across the room, you know, the softball look at his neck. And he was taking ibrutinib while we saw those lymph nodes. And I mean, you know, this is a guy who has already been extensively pretreated with chemotherapy and had shown himself to be refractory. Historically, there was no option for him. He started venetoclax in March of 2015 and has remained in a PR since that time, tolerated it extremely well. This was in the context of a clinical trial that he was on it. But he comes in and really feels fine. And this has been among the most durable of the responses that he's had since his initial exposure to FC chemotherapy.
So just, I'm going to get into the tumor lysis thing in a second, but just to clarify in this patient then, what was the size of the largest nodes? Did he have any over 10 centimeter? What was his white count or lymphocyte count?
So his white count was, I think, in the 40,000 range when he finally started the venetoclax. But yes, he had very bulky adenopathy. And he had to be admitted to the hospital for the first week. And then he had to come back in for the second week. And that was all part of the clinical trial. And essentially, laboratory tests were done. And as soon as there was evidence of biochemical tumor lysis, the trial directed us to admit the patient for intensive management. Those precautions were put in because there were some deaths that were seen. I think that it's a conservative approach because the venetoclax now is ramped up much more slowly in the dosing compared to the original studies where those deaths were seen. And, you know, it's probably the case that if you did this very careful biochemical monitoring, many of our treatments that are cytotoxic would cause tumor lysis that was at a biochemical level. So people are being conservative, but he actually weathered that just fine. By the end, he almost started to like being in the hospital, I think. And since that initial couple of weeks, he's been without infection, feeling well, and really still has some disease that you can see on imaging, but he's had an excellent PR to the treatment.
So his lymph nodes pretty much went away clinically?
Yeah, you can still feel them, but you certainly don't see them anymore in the neck. And, you know, the largest lymph nodes in the abdomen that started in the 10 to 12 centimeter range are now maybe 3 or 4 centimeters. And I think that's a common theme with a couple of these agents, is that as efficacious as they are, true CRs are rare. And I think that what that means for durability, we'll have to see. It may certainly give us the opportunity to use these drugs in rational combinations as well to get deeper responses.
So, yeah, I wanted to probe a little bit more in terms of this tumor lysis thing. What's this patient's white count now?
It's normal. I think he's had flow cytometry done to show that there still are circulating CLL cells. So I think his white count is in the 8 to 10,000 range, but he has maybe a mild lymphocytosis of about 5 to 6,000.
Did you see with him, and do you see with venetoclax, the spike in white count that you can see with ibrutinib?
Not as much as you see with ibrutinib. I mean, the real spike in white count that we see that is most apparent are with drugs like ibrutinib or the PI3 kinase inhibitors as well. Anything along that B-cell receptor pathway seems to really do that.
And getting back to where we are today, of course, ibrutinib now, after first being approved for 7TP, now is approved, period, in CLL. There's been a lot of debate even before that approval about what the optimal first-line therapy is. What are you doing in your practice nowadays?
So interesting, because in parallel with that approval has been a resurgence of enthusiasm, I think, for FCR chemotherapy, with some 15-year follow-up from MD Anderson's data in particularly the subset of more favorable CLL, the mutated CLL, suggesting really what appears to be a plateau on the progression-free survival curve. So I think that with that tension, what many of us are doing is in the younger patient population who we think is capable of receiving FCR, FCR remains a standard. But for the older patients or the patients that are more frail, where you're worried about toxicity, and of course that's the majority of these patients because it's a disease of older people, those patients I've likely considered ibrutinib as frontline versus BR. I should mention there are two major trials that were conducted in the United States by the cooperative groups that will definitively answer these questions. Both of them are now closed to accrual, so we're just waiting on results. One of them was FCR versus ibrutinib and rituximab in the younger patient population. And in the older patient population, there was a study of BR versus ibrutinib alone versus ibrutinib plus rituximab. And I've had patients on both of those trials, randomized to all the arms. Of course, initially, the CR rates are going to be higher with FCR. I have no doubt about that. The question will be durability of ibrutinib up front and how it compares. Clearly, the toxicity profile is very different. It was one of the trials that I felt most passionate about, but it was also one of the trials that was a hard trial to discuss with patients because you're saying you're either going to just take this pill or you're going to get standard FCR chemotherapy with all these risks. Yet, we got patients on, and the one patient of mine who got randomized to the FCR told me she was relieved that she was randomized to that arm. And I had to walk in the room being so disappointed because I figured most people wanted the ibrutinib at that time. So I think this will play out, but I would say that for the practicing oncologist, I think it's a little early to take all of the younger patients and not give them this possibility of really long remissions. I question cures in the use of FCR.
Yeah, I know. When I first heard about the randomization of FCR versus ibrutinib, I was like, well, you'll never get this done. So congratulations to all the investigators involved with that. But you mentioned, for example, BR in older patients, but also, as we were talking about before, obinutuzumab, chlorambucil. And if you look at this, it seems like you hear a lot of people talking about FCR as a way to launch people into an unmaintained remission that might last for years. But isn't that also true of BR and even, for example, obinutuzumab chlorambucil?
Yes, although I think the durability of obinutuzumab chlorambucil was much less than what's been seen in the subset of FCR. Now, that's not surprising. You're dealing with an older patient population. by definition, you had to have comorbidities to get on that trial. So, I mean, it's really comparing apples and oranges for sure. But I think that the durability of the chlorambucil obinutuzumab was much less than what has been seen with the other two regimens you mentioned.
What about BR? I mean, can you again use this argument? Let's try to launch them into an unmaintained remission.
Sure. I mean, I think there are a subset of patients who get BR and do very well. Now, there was a randomized trial comparing BR to FCR, and although the response rates were very good in both arms, at least from a progression-free survival standpoint, it did appear that FCR won out, but was more toxic. And I think that the magic age appeared to be in the 60 to maybe 62 range. So if you have patients around that age, it may be that the toxicity of FCR overwhelms the efficacy benefit. But for the patient, the uncommon patient who presents at a much younger age, I think that there's a consensus now based on the randomized trials that if you're going to use a chemo immunotherapy platform to launch them into a prolonged PFS, that it's the FCR regimen that does that. I'll mention one abstract from ASCO that was relevant here. There was a maintenance abstract in CLL after FCR light. It was four cycles of FCR, and then they looked at rituximab maintenance versus observation. And there was some progression-free survival benefit to rituximab maintenance, absolutely no overall survival benefit, and there was increased toxicity with more infections and a hint toward the possibility of increased second malignancies. So I think the authors concluded that they weren't going to do that, certainly in all patients. I felt in the discussion that that shouldn't be really a standard in the United States at all.
So I'm really curious what your thoughts are. You mentioned the issue of tumor lysis syndrome, what happened with this patient. When I saw the package insert for venetoclax, and they've got this table there that tells you kind of what to do, your patient would have been high risk.
Yes.
They would have said, put the patient in the hospital. I don't think I've ever seen a package insert like that. Have you?
No, not certainly in the lymphoma field. I mean,
in terms of specific algorithms for tumor lysis syndrome, have you ever seen that in a package insert?
No, I mean, I think that that drug took a very long time to really hit the market. It was a drug that I think we were excited about the target for many, many years, and the tumor lysis observation really shut down the development of that drug for a fairly prolonged period of time until it got teased out. And I think what it taught us was that there's real mortality risk to being cavalier about the way you give that drug. And I think given the fact that it's a pretty simple oral formulation, they had this risk that people were going to be prescribing the drug, patients would go home, and nobody would be looking at them until their appointment in 2 weeks. It was a little different from a chemotherapy indication. And I think that that's what's driving a lot of this, is that we're adjusting to the world of oral therapeutics in lymphoma. When I think about it, you know, you give somebody R-CHOP and you think they're high risk, it's almost automatic. You'll have them come back the next day, maybe get some fluids. And that's how we're used to treating patients. When you write this prescription, you know, I think a lot of times, instead of coming back the next day, you say, we'll see you in a week or we'll see you in 2 weeks. And I think that's what the sponsors were trying to avoid.
So I think it's really an interesting question. It also makes me wonder whether or not maybe things, as you were sort of alluding to, maybe tumor lysis happens sometimes, we don't realize it. Maybe people are getting hurt and we don't realize it. But let me tell you about a couple of case situations that we actually talked about at ASCO. I'm curious what you would do. We actually had two really cool CLL cases of patients who had white cancer. Was it, you know, over 120,000. One was 150, one was 120. Not a whole lot of adenopathy. And the patients were going to get BR. Okay, so, you know, common situation, I guess. And the question that I would ask is, in a patient like that, how would you approach the way you dose and the schedule of BR? Would you give both drugs up front? Would you give allopurinol? What kind of hydration would you do, if any, beyond, let's say, oral? And what kind of electrolyte renal monitoring would you do in this very common situation?
So I had that situation, and I candidly got burned once. A guy who was an older patient who had a relatively compromised GFR at baseline. I think his creatinine was maybe 1.5, and he was 78 or 80 years old. So if you calculate a creatinine clearance on him, it was low. I said, oh, you know, we don't generally see tumor lysis, gave him BR, and he ended up needing dialysis for a brief period of time and then fortunately recovered. What I would probably do now, I certainly would not give rituximab with the first cycle. I think there's no urgent need to give rituximab, and there's clearly toxicity that can be driven by a high lymphocyte count with rituximab. I would certainly give allopurinol, and I think that we would monitor his blood counts as an outpatient. I will say that in the large series of CLL patients that have been treated with BR, that the risk of tumor lysis leading to dialysis or other morbid endpoints has been, you know, a very small number of patients. So I think that, that having been said, you know, if there were any compromise in renal function to begin with, or if you started to see changes that concerned you, I think you'd have to have a low threshold to be more aggressive in your management of tumor lysis.
And again, in this situation, preemptively, IV or oral hydration?
If I'm going to do it, I'd give IV hydration. And, you know, part of that's just because you know what the patient's getting. Bendamustine is a drug that's given over 2 days anyway, so it's pretty easy on the second day to have the patient there rather than just get their infusion of bendamustine, go home, let them stay and get a liter of fluid. And then you can try to base whether you have the patient come back later. Encouraging oral hydration is always helpful, although I worry about compliance.
When we discussed the case, Brad Call brought up a point I had not heard before, which was his concern for using allopurinol and bendamustine together, potential for Stevens-Johnson syndrome.
Yeah, so there is increased skin toxicity, we'll call it, or rash, that's been observed with bendamustine compared to R-CHOP or other regimens. There's no doubt about that. Up to 20% of patients can get a rash associated with bendamustine. And in the STILL study that looked at this, there did appear to be an increased risk of developing a major skin toxicity when allopurinol was used. So there is a relative concern around those two drugs. I don't think it's at the level of a black box kind of thing as far as the way I think about it, but it's patient needs to be monitored closely. Whether you absolutely need to avoid allopurinol in somebody getting bendamustine, especially if they've been on allopurinol for a period of time, I think the risk is not a high risk, but clearly it's something that has been published and appreciated.
So switching from B-cell to T-cell lymphoma, I'm curious where you and your group are in terms of CD30 testing.
So in T-cell lymphoma, we do it in all cases. In fact, if it's not done at our tumor board conference every week, that's the first question we ask, is CD30 positive? Because it's becoming more and more, I think, a go-to therapy. If, you know, in first relapse of T-cell lymphoma, if somebody's CD30 positive, we would use brentuximab vedotin probably over some of the histone deacetylase inhibitors or other treatments. And obviously, even in the upfront setting, there are clinical trials that are looking to incorporate it.
Could I just clarify one thing? Because I just saw some data that said that with peripheral T-cell not otherwise specified, more than half the patients are CD30 positive?
Yeah, to get the firm number on what the percentage is, I think is hard because, as we've talked about before, I think, first of all, there is not a direct correlation to CD30 positivity and response. And second of all, there are some patients that maybe 1% of the cells are CD30 positive, and you know there's clearly going to be some error there. That having been said, when we do the study in our lab, if we see a fair amount of CD30 positivity, we certainly would move quicker to brentuximab vedotin than if we didn't. In T-cell lymphoma, it's a standard. We certainly do it on all the skin ones as well. In B-cell lymphoma, we actually are about to open a trial just here in Rochester, looking at the elderly population, combining brentuximab vedotin with mini R-CHOP. And in that study, we are going to be doing CD30 testing both centrally, but as well as using quantitative image analysis to really look and see if there's a cutoff that you can determine whether there may be some benefit to the addition of brentuximab. Outside of a clinical trial, we are not generally doing CD30 testing unless there's a specific scenario where we'll look at it on the B-cell side.
That's a fascinating study, though. So the patient gets in either way, but
yes,
then you test them. Wow, that's a great study.
But the study is powered for the group that is CD30 positive. We actually don't know in the elderly patient population what that number is, because a lot of the retrospective data comes from academic centers that don't see a lot of these patients or don't tissue bank them. But it could be argued that they're more likely to be CD30 positive, both because they're more likely to be non-GCB and because EBV positivity, which goes along with CD30 positivity, is certainly enriched in the elderly patient group. We're going to be incorporating geriatric assessments into that as well. One of my younger colleagues here, Patrick Reagan, is taking on that study. And I think it'll be an interesting contribution in the setting of other randomized and single-arm studies that are looking at incorporating brentuximab into the R-CHOP regimen.
And I guess the confusion that's been out there is that it looks like some patients who are, quote, CD30 negative respond.
Right. And, you know, is that a microenvironment effect? Is it a lack of detection, or this new concept of the crossfire effect, where you actually, similar to radioimmunotherapy, you're bringing in the brentuximab vedotin, and the way that the poison on the brentuximab vedotin works is that it may be taken up by the non-malignant CD30 positive cell, and then the destruction of that cell does result in poison being in the environment. So there are really three theories as to why you could see a CD30 negative tumor still respond to B-vedotin.
Crossfire. So in other words, the dying normal cell kills the lymphoma cell?
Essentially, yes, because the drug is in the area, the vicinity. That's the way I would think about it.
Wow.
We saw that with radioimmunotherapy. That was clearly demonstrated. And in fact, it was the crossfire effect that caused a lot of the bone marrow toxicity and when that was being used. Now, with radiation, it made much more inherent sense to me. I'm still trying to get my arms around exactly how this is working in a tumor, but there's been clear dialogue that there is some sort of microenvironmental effect that happens, that you're not just disrupting the microenvironment, but by the microenvironment being CD30 positive, you're bringing this basically chemotherapy into the vicinity of the tumor.